You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, October 23rd, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, producer, director, writer of the film Money for Nothing Inside the Federal Reserve, Jim Bruce, joins us. Also on the program today, the myth or myths behind the medical device tax. JP Morgan, $13 billion fine. They really won't pay a lot of it. Also on the program today, dissent in the House of Fox. Fox News comedian Crowley has to apologize to Hannity. Also, guess who's going to benefit to the tune of $100 billion if the Keystone Pipeline is built? Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise.
It's good old American family, the Koch brothers. And in New York City, sort of a inspiring story of some parents who got that standardized test for their first grade kids, their kindergarten kids, canceled. All that and more on today's program. And something that will warm the cackles of our Friday theme song guy, Jimmy Reefer Cake. For the first time ever, a majority of Americans now support legalizing marijuana. According to the Gallup poll, a clear majority of Americans, 58%, say the drug should be legalized. This is in sharp contrast to the first time that Gallup ever polled this question back in 1969, after the Summer of Love, when only 12% favored legalization. Public support for legalization has more than doubled in the 70s, growing to 28%. It plateaued during the Reagan era and in the 90s. And since 2000... it has gone up to 58%. In 2011, it was 50%. So it's hard to say how many years out we are from legalization across the country, but there are literally hundreds of millions of dollars per year to be saved in that case. And it's going to be interesting to see how, where the pushback comes from. We now have two states where it's where marijuana has been decriminalized and legalized. And the Department of Justice, you'll recall, has said that those states can go forward, Colorado and Washington, with their legalization regimes as long as it meets certain criteria, which ones that I think are quite reasonable. So we will see. All right. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment with director Jim Bruce of the movie Money for Nothing Inside the Federal Reserve. We'll be back in a moment. Hey, listeners of the Majority Report, you've heard me talk about our sponsor for this month. I'm talking about Credo Mobile. They are a dream sponsor. It's one of those sponsors where their agenda aligns with the agenda of this program. That is to fight regressive policies, whether you're talking about fighting against Tea Party members of the House or fighting against weak-kneed Democrats. Credo Mobile donates a huge chunk, 1% of their revenues, to progressive nonprofits. They've given over $75 million since 1985 to places like the Rainforest Action Network, Democracy Now!, the ACLU. They've got 3 million activists who fight for things like Medicare and against the Keystone XL pipeline. Credo Mobile helps fuel this Credo action fights. You can join today. Go to credomobile.com/Sam, and you got a deal that runs only till October 31st. They'll give you $350, or up to $350, I should say, credit for switching over if your current provider charges you a fee. They'll also give you 25% discount on data for 2 years, and that's true unlimited data. So check it out now. Go to credomobile.com/Sam, or we got links on the homepage of majority.fm. Check it out today. Help sponsor this program. Help a sponsor that is fighting for the same things that you're fighting for. Do it now. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Jim Bruce. He's the producer, director, and writer of the documentary Money for Nothing Inside the Federal Reserve. Welcome to the program, Jim.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, all right, Jim, let's just start. Why did you make this film? And I got to mention that part of the film was financed by your foreseeing the financial crisis of 2008 and apparently doing some short trades in anticipation of that crisis.
Yeah. I bet against a lot of these big financial firms that got into trouble in 2007 and 2008 and made some money doing it. I didn't work in finance. I didn't have a huge bank account to work with, but I did make enough money to put a good down payment on the film. And you know, my perspective has just been working in the film business, but always for some reason, I think I just had an interest in financial markets because I think we've been living through interesting times in America in terms of what's been happening in our stock and housing market. We had this huge bubble in the 90s. And as that burst, I sort of was scratching my head and looking around saying, what just happened? You know, what is that all about? And I began to sort of study finance and economics just sort of as in a hobby way. And in the early to mid 2000s, we had this huge housing bubble, which I think the Fed helped to create, because they were trying to make up for the stock bubble bursting. And so we've kind of lurched from one big problem to another in our financial system. And I viewed the Fed as being central to that. And a lot of the economists in our film were people who were writing in the early to mid 2000s that this was going to be a big disaster, and they were right, and I was listening to them and sort of took action accordingly. And then in 2009 and 10, in the wake of the crisis, I felt like, here we go again. The Fed is doing all the same things it did in the early 2000s to start the housing bubble. Now it's just starting to show up in housing lately. But it's been showing up in the stock market, if you've been paying attention. You know, it's going up 25% a year, whatever it is. And they're basically, I think, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. So I felt like someone should make a film about the Fed, this big institution that's incredibly powerful, that so few people understand, but has such a big impact on our lives, because I think they keep, creating these bubbles that then burst.
All right, let's go through the film, because the film is basically walks us through the development of the Fed, and then hits some key points sort of leading up to 2008 through the past 20 or 30 years, and then there's some aspects of your film towards the end that I take some issue with. But one of the things that I sort of found also fascinating about the film was that you had economists who had been writing about the bubble, and you also have a lot of people who were formerly at the Fed.
And some currently.
and some currently as well. Before we get into to those aspects, let's just walk us through, because I think one of the things that's really great about the film is it makes what is a fairly sort of Byzantine and opaque system, it makes it fairly clear. Just going over obviously every step of what you cover in the film, but just tell us a little bit about the development of the Fed. What were the forces that brought it about, and sort of its early development?
Yeah, well, that's part of the interesting story. It was originally, Fed was created in 1913. We'd had a big banking panic in 1907, very similar to the crisis in 2007. Ironically, these things aren't new. They happen throughout history, these big moments where there's been maybe some bad loans and everyone tries to pull their money out of the banks all at once and you have a big problem. So people at that time, politicians and bankers, felt like we needed a central bank, which other European countries had, which could, in the middle of a crisis, the central bank has this power to just create money. So when all of a sudden everyone's panicking and it's like Jimmy Stewart, everyone's trying to pull their money out of the bank at once, there's an institution that can provide currency to people so you don't have these panics. And originally the Fed wasn't really supposed to do a whole lot but provide money when all of a sudden there wasn't enough of it, which would happen at different times, in our history. And over the course of its history, the Fed expanded, and that's part of the story. They expanded into trying to impact the economy, which they started to do in the 1920s by raising and lowering interest rates. It wasn't created to do anything with the economy or even to manage the value of the dollar, which is something we sort of charge the Fed with today. But basically, over time, we've added, the Fed itself has added things that it started to do, and we've, as a nation and Congress, has started to ask the Fed to do more things. So today, we're asking the Fed to promote full employment in our economy, to help the economy grow more quickly. And we're also asking the Fed to manage the value of the dollar, to manage inflation, and to maintain the stability of the financial system. And so if you look at what the Fed's doing right now, one of the things we argue is that in the 80s and 90s, it sort of somehow became the Fed's job to make the stock market go up. I mean, that was something that Alan Greenspan liked to do and thought was important at different times to sort of boost stock prices. He thought that was something that would help the economy. If you look, fast forward to today, now the Fed is even more involved in the housing market. Ben Bernanke in 2012 said, our policies are going to help housing prices go up. So somehow the Fed has expanded from this very narrow thing that was supposed to help banks during crises to this agency that has a huge impact on our economy and is touching all these different markets. It's the Fed right now has more, owns more government debt than China, for example. It has almost twice what China has. So it's a huge player in all of our biggest markets. And I would argue it's part of the story is as a nation we're relying more and more on our central bank. And what the central bank does is subsidize and promote financial activity. And so we have this big financial sector in our economy supported by a central bank that has this power to create money. And I think what we've been seeing over recent years is our real economy sort of withering and stagnating. But if you work in finance, everything's great, you know.
Right.
So I feel like we've kind of created this strange I think we're sort of distorting our economy by having such a powerful central bank. I think in the long run its policies aren't going to work, so it's not, I don't think it's a long-term powerful thing, but I think in the short term it's created all these distortions. And we, you know, we sort of argue in the film that it's time that we sort of start to focus on our real economy, and it would be great if the central bank would sort of stop doing these things.
I want to get to that part of the film in a bit, because I think, you know, that's one of the areas where I have some sort of disagreement.
Question.
I want to get to quantitative easing and the mandates of the Fed. But one of those mandates, and you walk us through, I mean, the irony as we go through the history of the Fed is that it's not the existence of the Fed that is problematic. At different times, it's the policy decisions that they make. I mean, for instance,
absolutely,
during the Great Depression, one of the problems was the Fed actually did nothing. That's
the amazing thing. The Fed was created to prevent banking panics, right? And then sort of 20 years later, we have this massive banking panic. And they didn't do anything, almost. I mean, and at that time, it was also, there was no deposit insurance. So that some people compare today's, you know, our recent crisis with the Great Depression. And it's a totally different story, I would argue. At that time, you know, can you imagine just losing your entire bank account balance because, you know, you put it in Lehman Brothers, for example. So there's a big difference. But yes, and we had a huge banking panic. They were created to prevent banking panics and to help, you know, the economy deal with it, and they just simply didn't do it. And that's one of our, you know, one of the parts of our story is that, for one thing, you know, this was a new organization. We're learning about economics even today. I think a lot of economists, you know, didn't see the crisis coming. The biggest event in the last 10 years was largely missed by the establishment. So it's something where we're trying to learn about these things. And one of the goals of the film is to move that bar a little forward, to say, hey, let's learn the lessons from the past.
So let's jump up to 1987 and when we had this stock market crash. The Fed at that time, led by Greenspan, in your film, I mean, I think the broad consensus is that the Fed stopped a potential for even greater crisis.
Absolutely.
Talk about how that happened, because I mean, this was sort of the beginning of the deification of Alan Greenspan, and one that, sadly, I mean, the guy has been trotted out just this week on the J.P. Morgan fines, and it's almost as if this guy's credibility can never wane.
He's a fascinating character, really. And Greenspan, if you look at 1987, Alan Greenspan took over at the Fed in August of 1987. And in October of 1987, we had the worst one-day crash in the stock market in U.S. history. The stock market dropped, I believe, it was over 20. It might have been 25%, roughly, in one day.
It was Black Monday, if I remember
this
correctly.
This is Black Monday, and really the worst day in U.S. market history. And a lot of people, you know, Greenspan was not, you know, there was a lot of question marks about who was this guy, you know, who had just come in. Paul Volcker had been the previous chairman and had enormous respect from the markets. People didn't really know Greenspan, and he really sort of had a baptism of fire. And the Fed was, it was also people in the New York Federal Reserve, not just Alan Greenspan, but the Fed was instrumental in we really could have had a Great Depression-like moment at that point. Markets seized up, and with a drop that quickly, banks in New York were not willing to lend to each other because a lot of banks were effectively insolvent, and the Fed stepped in as it should do and prevented this quick drop in the stock market from turning into, you know, the destruction of our entire financial system. So that's a healthy thing. But I think one of the issues is that it created this precedent, and I think we follow that story through history, is that people who trade, you know, stocks and who work in the financial markets began to see the Fed as having their back whenever anything went wrong. And I think we follow Alan Greenspan's trajectory. There's this great irony of this guy who believed in free markets, but when things went wrong, he believed in government intervention suddenly, you know. So I think we started to have this, you know, in the short run, it's a good thing. We didn't want the whole financial system to fall apart in 1987 or in 2008. But when you're backing up people who make poor decisions, over a time, I think you start to encourage this riskier and riskier behavior. And what we saw during Alan Greenspan,
in that situation, what we have is a classic case of we are privatizing the profits, but we are socializing the risk. And basically saying to these guys, you know, go to town. And if you crack up the car, don't worry, we'll fix it for you, type of situation.
Absolutely. And I think we're right back there right now, to me. I mean, I want to get to
the current situation, because I'm not so convinced that, I mean, I think we share a similar issues. I'm not so convinced we're in that exact same situation, but, Because following that, we see a period of asset inflation, and to the point where at one point Greenspan seems to recognize it, and he's talking about irrational exuberance. Nobody listened to him, so he figures, you know what? Why be the party pooper?
Yep. I mean, I think that's one of the big challenges, is if we're having a central bank that's going to stoke the stock market, then you'd think, well, at some point they also have to dampen it down, right? And really, with Greenspan, he made an early attempt with it. We had this huge stock boom, unprecedented in U.S. history in the 90s. I think part of that was this sense that we had a Fed that was gonna make sure everything was all right. And in 1996, Greenspan did give a speech saying, "Hey, things are getting out of hand," and he really got sort of attacked for it. And ultimately he changed his stance. He had said we had a stock bubble in 1996. You fast forward to 1999, the stock market has, you know, doubled or tripled, since he said there was a bubble. And he's saying, well, we can't really be sure if there are bubbles. You never really know. So it's not our job to talk about bubbles. So basically sometimes it's the Fed's job to get the stock market to go up, but it's never the Fed's job to get it to go down. So I think we have this idea, this perception in the markets, that it's a one-way street, that right now the Fed won't let the market go down, but they'll certainly let it go up, so you might as well buy. And I think it creates an incentive for people to do foolish things.
Yes, and I agree with that, but let's also talk about, during that period, the size of the financial sector more than doubled, and we saw a greater financialization. And I would argue the story is even bigger than what you touch upon, and you just touch upon it briefly in the film, of our economy, where you know, even GM was really not so much a car company in terms of where its profits came from, but a company that financed the purchase of cars.
Absolutely. Companies, you know, GM was making money on the loans, not on the cars themselves. Sort of amazing. GE, people think of as, oh, they make light bulbs and jet engines and all these things. GE was an enormous, highly levered financial company, you know, and they did do these other things, but it's a huge part of their business became finance. And I think my way of thinking about it is basically the Federal Reserve is very powerful, and they have the ability at different times to stimulate financial activity, stimulate financial markets. But the Fed's reaction to every crisis the last 25 years has been to stimulate financial markets. So we keep subsidizing. You know, if the Federal Reserve, with all the power that it has to sort of create money and drive credit, if they said, you know, we want to subsidize, you know, taco carts or something, you know, there'd be people, you know, the average taco cart owner in New York would be making $360,000. But in fact, it's the case is we're subsidizing people in finance.
Right.
So the average financial worker in New York City makes $360,000. You know, that's a fact reported recently. So, you know, again, I think it's this choice of it's in some ways easier because, you know, the Fed, their officials, they're not elected. We don't have to get Congress to agree on anything like we would for a big, you know, economic program of some kind. So I think we've, you know, as a nation, we've sort of seen it as easier to rely on finance, to rely on this, you know, this central bank to sort of help out when times get rough, because in some ways it's easier than doing actual things in the real economy, than actually building things or funding large, you know, we could get a new power grid, but gosh,
right.
That would involve a lot of votes and a lot of
right.
actual people going out and hanging power lines. You know, in some ways, it's easier. Well, if we just get the housing market to go up 20% a year, or the stock market to go up 20% a year, the economy will do better. You know, in the short run.
Right. Well, one of the things that struck me about your film, and it was sort of I saw it in the form of some of the former and current members of the Fed. Was that they talk about, because one of the things obviously that the Fed also does, and maybe that's sort of implicit in the notion of maintaining the integrity of our financial systems, is they are one of the chief regulators. And
ironically.
And it seems to me that the perspective of some of those Fed officials continues to be this notion of like, well, look, we created certain incentives. And I think to a certain extent, your film reflects the similar notion that this is all about incentives. And I think that's true to a certain extent. And that, you know, when we say to the markets, like, look, you know, we're going to backstop you at any time. So, you know, feel free to take us to the craps table. But one of the things that also happened concurrent, particularly under Greenspan, was a tremendous amount of either deregulation from a statutory standpoint or deregulation, a de facto deregulation, because Greenspan had this belief that he sort of recanted upon and then sort of, you know, I don't know, sort of recanted sort of on his recantation that these banks would operate in their own best interests and regulate their own risk. And it seems to me that both the story of deregulation, both the story of the tremendous amount of fraud that was also involved, and yes, the fraud may have been incentivized in some way or rewarded even to a greater degree because of Fed actions during the 2000s, let's say.
Yep.
But there was a tremendous yep. amount of fraud. And the real difference is that when you had that long-term capital go under, the same reaction in the mid-90s, the same reaction did not take place as did with the savings and loan, where we also backstopped it. In other words,
yep.
you had, under the savings and loans, you had literally hundreds, if not more, people went to jail. But that
yep.
didn't happen with long-term capital, and it certainly didn't happen with the financial crisis. And then all of the other levels. I mean, tell me about your perspective on that, because I think in some way I felt that was underrepresented.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a big part of our story is that Alan Greenspan was the most, as the Fed chair, is the most powerful banking regulator that we have in our country. There's others with different jurisdictions. But he actually, throughout the housing bubble, was the one official who had the power to regulate all mortgage lenders, for example. And we had a huge amount of mortgage fraud. But Greenspan, this might have been, you know, we couldn't fit everything into this story.
Right.
But Greenspan is actually on the record as not believing that fraud is something the government should even concern itself with, because he thought if you're practicing fraud, the market will eventually find you out. And you'll go out of business. And he literally didn't. And he said this to a powerful regulator who is in the film, Brooks Lee Bourne, who was the person that tried to regulate the derivatives market, had the power to do it in 1998. And Greenspan and Larry Summers and Bob Rubin and other officials, you know, sort of attacked her and took that power away from her. And so he actually didn't believe that fraud is something we should concern ourselves with or even try to find or try to prosecute. So that you're starting from a pretty tough spot if that's your most powerful banking regulator. But you have to remember this was a very popular notion that worked for Democrats and Republicans, that you know, a lot of this legislation happened under the Clinton administration,
as many
conservative people want to remind me of. And so basically it was something that was very popular within economics, was this idea that markets know best and the government doesn't know what it's doing, and so there isn't a role for government in regulating these things. And so that put us really behind the eight ball. And then, you know, my way of thinking about it is that we basically ceded that role of you know, you would hope when people are doing stupid things that there is a regulator in markets to try to keep the game fair, for example. You know, if you had a basketball game, you want to have a referee there so that people aren't just punching each other in the face when somebody's driving to the net. And I think, you know, in this instance, the markets really turned into, you know, a really total free-for-all. But the interesting thing about it is Greenspan afterwards will say, well, how could I have known, and different things. But he was also, he wanted people to take risk in 2003 and 4 and 5.
2004, he went up and said, basically, to the American public, you're an idiot if you don't get an adjustable rate mortgage.
Exactly. And then, of course, he goes and raises interest rates, you know, however many times, 17 times in a row, just completely screwing anyone who had taken his advice. So, yeah, the irony is that the Fed, during this time when people were, where you could argue doing foolish things, whether it was home buyers or lenders or,
but I mean, we're talking about fraud. I mean, it's not just a question of foolish things. I mean, we
yeah.
know that we know that anyone from the like 1,000 assessors of property had written the federal government and said, hey, there's a lot of fraud here. We now
Absolutely.
Know that these banks and these mortgage originators were giving bonuses if you basically engaged in overt predatory lending practices. I mean, there was and we now know also, I mean, as of this week at least, the J.P. Morgan was turning around and selling these securities, knowing what they were selling were piles of crap. I mean,
absolutely.
This is all, I mean, because there was a quality that I got in literally some of these notes are sitting on my kids' changing table right now at home. But there was one or two Fed, former Fed officials who spoke about the lack of regulation as if it was sort of just creating an atmosphere where something would grow naturally, as opposed to saying, hey, yeah, we let the cops off the beat, but that didn't mean that there should be rampant crime spree. And in many respects,
yep.
that's what we got in that buildup.
Absolutely. I mean, and I would argue that the Fed, you know, the Fed was wrong on both sides. They were both,
right.
you know, if you think about a crime spree, they're arming people. You know, they're handing out guns and knives and things. And then they're also looking the other way, you know, shutting their window. They were supposed to be, you know, that's one of the things we asked them to do, and it's in their purposes and functions that they publish on their website, ensure the safety and soundness of the financial system. And that is the opposite of what they did during this period. You know, I think they both encouraged the bad behavior, they provided incentives for it, and they did nothing to stop it. And the Fed, one example is liar loans, which are loans, and that was a term people in the industry actually used as early as 2000. So you have to realize, oh God, we got a problem here if they're calling them that.
Right.
But it's basically loans where people, mortgages where people would simply state their income. So you could walk in there as, you know, as a janitor and say, I make $200,000 a year, please give me this loan. And all you had to do was just say that you made the money. There was no verification required, no tax returns or check stubs or anything like that. And these became incredibly popular. I think by 2006, it was 50% of loans in California, huge percent nationwide. And the Fed actually all along, later on, even Ben Bernanke would say, oh, we didn't have the power to regulate. We only regulate some banks. We weren't in charge of Wall Street. But the Fed in 1994, in the wake of the savings and loan crisis, had been given the power to regulate all mortgage lenders. So they could have said, as they actually did and they started enforcing this in 2009.
Right. They subsequently
You have to check people's income before you make a mortgage. Everyone in America now has to check people's income. That's a pretty simple thing to call for. But by the time they enforced it in 2009, I mean, Bernanke even wasn't willing to enforce it in 2008. They passed the bill in 2008, and he said, well, it won't go into effect till 2009. At that point, it had been about 2 years before, you know, since anyone had made that kind of loan. Nobody was making them anymore. So it was totally ineffectual. And basically, I think afterwards, Bernanke has really, I think, distorted the story in terms of what he said. He would say, and Greenspan would say the same thing, oh, we weren't overseeing Wall Street. But no, the Fed had the power. Lehman Brothers, for example, was a huge maker of these liar loans. The Fed had the authority to regulate anyone making a mortgage in America. It didn't matter what type of bank they were or investment bank. And they didn't use it. And I think that's the story going forward. If you're looking, you know, one of my arguments with people say, okay, well, we just needed to regulate. It's all we needed to do. It doesn't have to do with interest rates and things like that. And I would say, how can you be so sure we're going to regulate next time? Because part of the story is there was, you know, Barney Frank on the Democratic side and there's people on the Republican side. In 2004 and 5, no politician wanted the housing bubble to be slowed down or stopped. You know, that's the tricky part, is that somebody's making money with all this fraud. So there's people that support the banks in terms of, in Washington, there's congressmen who say, oh, our banks are making all these profits, let's not stop then. And some people said, well, it's getting people into houses, so let's not stop that. And so there wasn't, if you look at Washington in 2004 and 5, and if the Fed had, Greenspan had no interest in doing this, but if the Fed had said, okay, we're going to stop these liar loans, there probably would have been a large outcry. You know, it would have slowed down a housing bubble, which was popular.
Right.
You know, and I think the problem is that's why the Fed has its independence. That's what we want the Fed to do. But the tricky thing going forward is I don't think we can expect the Fed to be that smart to see these things ahead of time. You know, I don't, that's I think one of the problems is I think you can say, well, why didn't they regulate? And, you know, you both have to have the desire, but you also have to have the understanding that there's a problem. And I think the Fed could have had that understanding pretty easily. It wasn't hard to see. But, you know, the history of the Fed is that they often make these sort of big mistakes, you know. And in the Great Depression, 4,000 banks failed. The Fed was worried about, you know, lending money to banks.
They were worried in some respects about inflation. I mean, then let's talk about where we are today, and
yep.
The last third or so of the film gets a little bit ominous in terms of and talks about this perspective that you share, that we are in inflating assets again, and much to the same ends, and
yep.
And this is where I don't share your same concerns. I mean, partially because this is not the 2000s. This is not the 90s. We are coming out of the wake of a massive recession, and we also have sort of the complete failure of fiscal policy in addressing this. And I think we probably would agree that there needs to be fiscal policy. The question is, in the absence or in the existence of basically austerity fever, which still is gripping our government, what else is there to do, and why is there a danger now? I mean, I agree that the quantitative easing, and you can explain that for folks, is not terribly efficient, and it's mostly enriching rich people.
One way of thinking about it is this. If you proposed the plan and you said, I want to stimulate the economy, so I'm going to get a semi-truck and fill it with $100 bills, and I'm going to drive out to the Hamptons, and I'm just going to open the back, and I'm going to drive around with and just flood the Hamptons with $100 bills, right? The Hamptons in New York, very fancy area, a lot of wealthy people. That would stimulate the economy somewhat. There would be a lot of people in the Hamptons who would, you know, have, you know, $10,000 in their front lawn the next morning. But the question is, why would we choose that of all the different ways we could stimulate our
brain? Oh, no, I agree with you. I think what we should do is...
My way of thinking about it is there's these other things, and
I think
I
we should take that truck, and
argument,
I think we should take that truck, and I think we should drive it through the Bronx, frankly. And I honestly believe that's what we should be doing. I mean, we should have been providing
absolutely.
That relief directly to homeowners. But that doesn't mean... That doesn't mean that by dropping off that money in the Hamptons that we are risking another financial crisis in the near or midterm. I mean, those are two different arguments. I agree.
Yeah.
We should be taking that truck to the Bronx because those people are going to spend the money in a way that's going to be far more healthy for the economy than the people in the Hamptons. Because the people in the Hamptons, what are they going to do? They're going to buy another house in the Hamptons? No,
that's the irony. That's the irony. So to me, the benefits, and here's the problem. The problem, I think, is that if the Fed is trying to stimulate the economy, the Fed doesn't deal with poor people. The Fed does business with the largest banks in the world. And then it possibly could trickle down. And I think what we've seen for the last 5 years, a stat came out recently, 95% of the income gains
absolutely.
Since 2009 have gone to the richest 1%. So it's not working. And I would actually argue, as someone who saw the financial crisis and bet against things, I would argue the stock market today is in a very risky place, and I think it's underappreciated. And I think the Fed is the biggest driver of where the stock market is right now and has a lot to do with QE, quantitative easing. I don't think it actually works, but people on Wall Street think it works, and so it's driven the stock market up. I think it's a very shaky foundation. I think we've actually already begun taking prices back to a place in the stock market where there's actual real risk, and not of a tremendous collapse, but of this, I mean, historically a 30 or 40% drop. And so to me, we've created another, and if you look back at 2002 and 3 and 4, people were worried, the economy slowed down after this huge stock bubble. So what can we do? And the Fed's lowering interest rates. It's creating this housing boom. And at that time, you said, well, you know, this is good. This is helping, you know. And in the short term, it helps. But in the long term, in 2002, 3, 4, 5, we built a recovery that was based on cheap credit and on housing prices going up 15 or 20% a year. And you could say in the short run, the Fed was saying at the time, this is great. Look how our economy is now growing again, you know. And this is a healthy thing.
But the difference
was afterwards you said, "Oh, that's a disaster."
But wasn't the difference at that time though was that we also had fiscal stimulus? I mean, we literally had the Bush administration sending out checks to people. I mean, so this wasn't this isn't a question of inefficient monetary stimulus. At a time where we have fiscal austerity, it was a question of asset inflation and inefficient monetary stimulus at a time where we had also fiscal stimulus. I mean, so that to me seems like the big difference that's going on here is that, and I think, you know, we've seen it at least in terms of the logic of the Fed here, insofar as like the contemplation of a taper of quantitative easing, but they are looking at a completely dysfunctional Congress that is pushing an austerity agenda. And it seems to me that Bernanke has basically been saying, you guys, we have no options here. And so what in the absence of fiscal stimulus, because I think we both agree that's what needs to happen. The government needs to start spending money. I think, and I'm not as concerned with the debt as some of the people in your film seem to be. I mean, what is the danger here? Aside from the fact that, I mean, I agree, and I've talked ad nauseum about income inequality, and I do think that this is probably the most inefficient way that you could stimulate the economy, and it may arguably be having very little effects. But what is the big danger in the absence of any fiscal stimulus?
To me, the danger is there's two things. There's the short term and the long term. I think in the short term, the danger is that, for example, the stock market right now, you know, Fed policy, that they did a new round of quantitative easing in September of 2012. Bernanke in the press conference said this is going to push up stock prices and push up housing prices. I think Fed policy would work right now if stock prices were low and housing prices were low. I think if you look at a first-time buyer, if you look at anyone actually trying to buy a house with their own income, I think there's very few places. There's places that are falling apart. There's Detroit. There's places where things are just collapsing. There's very few places where house prices are just are too cheap, you know.
Right.
If you look at the stock market, not too cheap. Here's a stat. August home sales across the U.S., 45% of them were cash, okay? How many real people buy a house with cash? How many of those people in the housing market in August? 45% of sales were cash sales, and that's from the Huffington Post. And the reality is that is Wall Street money. It's people.
Yes, hedge funders
and people say it's Wall Street money, but it's really the Fed's money because they're hedge funds, they're private equity firms. They can borrow because the Fed is allowing them to and promoting this. They can borrow at 0.5% or 1% and buy a house. Now, the average person who has to borrow at 4% or 5% and actually is doing it out of their income is getting priced out. Prices are going up. The average person is saying now, okay, do I take, you know, I keep losing these bidding wars with these entities that can
right.
just magically pay cash because I actually have a mortgage and it would have to get approved and it would take 6 weeks. So a seller is saying, I'll take the guy who's giving me cash and nothing has to get approved. I know the deal will go through. So the Fed is, I think, again, distorting the housing market. This time it's not necessarily the mortgage market, although they're the biggest player. The Fed's buying $500 billion of mortgages each year. They're also Fed money, I think, is distorting the home buying market. So that, to me, is a problem. And then if I look at where stock prices are right now, I feel like we've just created a recovery that is a house of cards, that isn't, and this is in the short term, that isn't, it's not going to last. And it's sort of like, to me, if we, it's like the three little pigs or something like that. We have to start building a recovery that's based on real things. And it might be a little bit slower. It might take a little bit longer. But it's not the kind of thing where you're going to wake up the next morning and say, oh, the stock market's down 30%.
But what are the mechanics?
Everything's falling apart.
You see, I mean, I agree that what we need is I don't know if this is what you're talking about, but I think that we need to have government spending at this point because it's the only way to stimulate the economy, invest in the future, infrastructure, and basically putting people to work. But
I think
we don't have that. And I mean, it seems like, you know, in the absence of that happening from a political standpoint, and maybe we'll see the Democrats take control of the House and there'll be more spending and that we will get out of this austerity fever. I'm not even that convinced of that based upon what this administration seems to be convinced that they have a bit of an obsession with deficits, in my estimation. But but assuming that could that's not going to happen, what happens then? I mean, is the idea that if there's enough pain out there that maybe it will pressure the politicians, or what is the theory behind it in the absence of this?
I mean, basically, my theory is that what we're doing now is going to prove in the long run to be counterproductive. Just like having a housing bubble, if you look at 2002 and 3 and 4, you could say, oh, growth is slower than it was in the 90s. You know, there's more people. Ironically, unemployment, which the Fed was worried about in 2003, peaked at 6%. So we would dream of having those problems. But in 2003, they had seen 4.5% employment in the 90s, and they said, oh, it's at 6%. We gotta throw everything we can at this. We gotta stimulate the economy. And what they did, to my point of view, was counterproductive. It made things in the long run worse. We would have been better off if we didn't have a housing bubble in 03, 04, 05. And we have begun to adjust to this new globalized world where China is making a lot of things. And we've begun to look at all the things that you and I think would make sense. Infrastructure, retraining people, trying to have a more competitive economy when there's these other countries doing things. Like, those are the things that we need to do. And to me, pushing up the stock market more, fueling the housing market with this hedge fund money that's buying at 1%, buying up 45%.
Well, no, but wait a second. Here's the thing that doesn't...
That's going to be counterproductive, I think.
The reason why, it seems to me, the crash of the housing market was so problematic was that because people had bought these houses on credit, they had assumed that their house was a bank, essentially. They thought they were wealthier than they were. assume, and I agree with you. We got hedge funders going in there. They're buying up basically future slums, in my estimation. They're going to be, you know, absentee landlords. They're hoping that eventually they're going to rent these out. Let's assume for a moment, though, that they stop buying houses and the prices of houses fall, and somehow this affects the rental market as well, which it very well could. I mean, I think what's more problematic is you got these same hedge funders trying to securitize their future rents that they're going to be getting at these houses. But it's not going to have the same implications because your average person, like you say, has not engaged in this inflation of these homes. And if we saw a lot of people taking money out against their homes, which is much tougher because credit's tighter for these people, I would agree with you. But in the short term, in the absence of anything else, I don't think the answer is to have increased unemployment and basically, you know, create more human suffering. I mean, because that's what we're talking about, right? I mean,
but here, to me, this is the thing. The Fed is encouraging activity in the stock market, trading in the stock market going up. They're also encouraging resources going to the housing market. And they're doing that on purpose, because that's all really the only things they can touch. They can't start an infrastructure program or a jobs program or do any of these things. And my concern is that we had this crisis. One of the reasons our economy is stagnating is because in the 2000s we spent all this money investing in residential houses, which aren't productive. Housing, it's not an investment; it's a place to live. And see, I think now our solution to having this problem from overinvestment in housing is to encourage more investment in housing. And I think we have to have this totally different conversation, which is, how do we make our world better? How do we raise standards of living? What do we really need? Do we not have enough houses? There's millions and millions of vacant houses. Is housing too cheap? Is that the problem we face? And I would say that's not the problem we face. The problem is that we've been spending too much of our time on finance and housing,
right,
in part because this incredibly powerful institution is subsidizing those activities. And so it's really just a totally different conversation. So,
but I would argue that the main reason why we're doing that right now is because we have we have a political process that is bringing us austerity. And were we not in an age of austerity, I would agree with you more on those dangers. But we are. I mean, we have a tremendous amount of slack in our economy right now. And
absolutely. But I would argue not in the areas the Fed is stimulating. And I would say that in some ways that's why it's not working. That's not
right,
where we're not seeing, you know, great growth. We don't have a lack of activity in the stock market.
What do you see as the long term? What do you see as the long term danger here? Because this is where we get into that notion of inflation and that debt crisis, which frankly I think is a canard that is used.
I agree, and it's hard because in the film, you know, we spend a very short period of time in sort of the present day or whatever, because we're trying to give people a context for so much of the film. But basically, I don't think that's a short term issue. Inflation is not a short term problem. The deficit is not a short term problem. But it is, to me, so I think what's the next thing that's going to happen is deflationary. That's why I think what the Fed is doing right now is a bad idea, because I think they're pushing prices up that are going to go down next, you know, the stock market and things like that. Specifically, mostly the stock market. I don't think the housing market's that dangerous right now. I think it's mostly the stock market. But, so I think short term, the next few years, prices are going to fall. The dollar will become worth more in the short term. You know, government bonds may become more expensive, worth more in the short term. But I think the problem is the next recession that we have is going to come with the Fed already fully extended.
Right.
With the government having already borrowed $8 trillion, I think, to throw at the wrong things. I mean, we're spending it on defense. We're spending
it
on a very dysfunctional, you know, healthcare system where, you know, for whatever reason, you know, someone in Europe can get a hip replacement for $4,000 and someone in America gets the same hip for $40,000.
Yes.
You know, it's like whatever money we're spending, it's not being put to very good use, and it hasn't been for a long time. And so I think we're in that much of a weaker position where what we're doing right now, to me, is relying on our ability for the central bank to print money and the government to borrow money. And at some point, if that's what you're relying on in the long term, it's not a sustainable path.
I agree with you. I mean,
you know, if you go out 10, 15 years and you say, well, every year the Fed, because the Fed right now is creating $1 trillion new dollars a year. You know, some people don't realize that. You know, it's divided. It's only $85 billion a month, but it's $1 trillion new dollars a year. And I think, you know, if you look at what the government has done in the last, and I'm, you know, I'm not a deficit hawk, but in the last, you know, since the crisis began, and, you know, the government is, I think, you know, whatever it is, we're now at 17, so I think roughly $9 trillion further in the hole. And you know, what do we have to show for it? Are we spending it on the right things? And I think, to me, the big discussion has to be, okay, whatever the government is spending per year, $3.5 trillion or whatever, we have to, if we invest that well, we'll be better off and debt will start going down. You know?
Absolutely.
But if we invest it in, you know, tanks that nobody even in the military wants or whatever it is, you know, then we're going to have a bunch of tanks that nobody wants and the bill for it, you know. So the conversation has to be, what do we do with the resources that we have? And part of my issue with what the Fed is doing is I think it's a big distraction. I think the 90s stock boom was a distraction for the average person. The housing bubble was even bigger and dangerous, you know, more dangerous distraction because it got people.
These bubbles hide the reality of what, frankly, the vast majority of the country is experiencing.
Absolutely. And we waste our time and our resources, you know, renovating, you know, making sure we all have stainless steel appliances or something, you know, when we could actually be doing something, you know, far more useful, you know. And I think that's the question, is can we turn away from these things which we know, I think we should know by now, that stock market booms and housing booms, which we're pursuing right now very aggressively, you know, that those don't help us in the long run, but that all these other things, you know, could. And that's the question, is can we refocus on things that actually make people better off.
Jim Bruce, producer, director, writer of Money for Nothing Inside the Federal Reserve. I really appreciate your time today. I will reach out later for some stock tips from you.
Sell. All right. Thank you so much, Sam.
Thanks, Jim. All right,
okay,
folks.
Bye.
We're going to head into the went a little long there. You know, the guy's a filmmaker. I got to put myself out there.
The way you said that reminded me of, have you seen Anchorman?
No.
He goes, at one point they get into a street brawl and they're like, that escalated quickly.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the show. You know, Credo Mobile is our sponsor. They have a great deal for Majority Report listeners. It will end in 7 or 8 days, 7.5 days. On October 31st, right now, if you go to credomobile.com/Sam, you get up to $350 credit on your Credo bill to cover your changeover fees from whatever company you're working with now. On top of that, 25% off of data for 2 years. That's unlimited, true unlimited data. credomobile.com/Sam. I've talked about Credo plenty in the past. You know what they do. So head over now, there now. Of course, the way that you can really support this program, long-term, like a genuine investment in infrastructure. See where I'm going with this, folks? A genuine investment in the infrastructure of this program is to become a member at majority.fm. It is 35 cents a day. Every day we strive desperately, frenetically, sometimes obsessively, sometimes to the detriment of our sleep, to bring you interesting interviews, timely interviews, evergreen interviews, and insightful coverage into politics. So if you appreciate what you hear on a daily basis, become a member today. Support it as a bonus. We give you another 50 minutes of material, give or take. Some days we go longer in the free show. And you can also support this program by buying your Amazon junk through our Amazon link. You can find it at majority.fm. Bookmark it. Use it all the time, and we get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Want to be a part of today's program? Give me a call, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Tomorrow will be a Matt and Mike Thursday. We had a little shuffling of guests. So you will get to hear the dulcet sounds of Matt and Mike.
Where did the dulcet sounds come from?
I don't know. I don't even know what it means. I forgot to turn
on
my
good.
I will turn on my IM right now.
You know what my dad said one time about the show? It was like his strongest feedback he ever had to anything on the show was the intro you recorded for us when we were covering for you for your maternity or paternity leave. And you said, Matt and Mike and my other friends. And then you pause and you say, not that Matt and Mike are my friends. Nice acquaintances. My dad loved that. He never said, he's like, that's such a good intro. Not really my friends.
Well, I mean, if you say they're my friends, then all of a sudden you think that the assessment of their abilities may be in some way tainted.
Absolutely.
But I wanted to sound...
We need a Matt and Mike like intro, like how the Majority Report has the John Benjamin intro. And instead of like, do you ever have the feeling you're getting cheated? It's just you going, they're not my friends. And it goes right into us.
All right, folks.
And now, my pleasant acquaintances.
Yes, and now I'd like to bring up to the stage longtime acquaintances who I have some measure of appreciation for. All right, folks. See you in the better half.